There were four people on board. All four people sustained fatal injuries.
A deadly plane crash near Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a rural lawmaker protests changes to the Power Cost Equalization Fund plan.
They changed the formula on how the excess of earnings will be distributed, and I believe that that formula will potentially put the fund in jeopardy.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
An early morning plane crash near Anchorage has claimed four lives. As Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer reports, the Cessna 172 accident is currently under investigation.
National Transportation Safety Board investigator Sean Williams said the plane took off from Birchwood Airport Wednesday morning and crashed at about 9:05 in a densely wooded area. Investigators have determined the model of the plane, which burned on impact. Sean Williams.
The type of aircraft has been identified as a Cessna 172. The tail number was confirmed to be November 63541. There were four people on board. All four people sustained fatal injuries.
The area of the crash is located off a muddy dog sled track about a mile from Birchwood Airport. Williams says preliminary information indicates the plane took off from the airport, but why it crashed is not clear. He says the investigation is made more difficult because the airplane fragmented when it hit trees going down.
The debris field spans about 100 yards.
And the fire consumed important details.
Everything from fuel lines to avionics to anything that could be inside the airplane.
Investigators have recovered the bodies and next of kin have been notified. Anchorage police have identified the victims as pilot George Kabelnik, age 54, co-pilot Christian Borer, age 20, and passengers Sarah Glaves, age 36, and Kyle Braun, aged 27. Williams says the NTSB plans to recover the wreckage on Thursday and take it to storage for more detailed evaluation. After that, investigators will know more. He says so far there is no evidence of a flight plan and the destination is not known at this time. Williams told reporters at an impromptu press conference that the airplane was capable of carrying four people. Williams says further investigation will focus on the pilot, the plane itself, and the environmental conditions at the time of the crash. A representative from Cessna is expected to arrive this week to help in a, quote, detailed engine examination. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The U.S. Senate is the final resting place for a lot of legislation, but this week it revived Senator Lisa Murkowski's energy modernization bill, which had been in a coma since February, as senators feuded over what to do about the Flint water crisis. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the energy bill's passage is a political coup for Murkowski.
The bill sailed through the Senate by a vote of 85 to 12. And not for nothing, because Murkowski, the chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, says she and the committee's top Democrat, Maria Cantwell of Washington, included policy priorities and sometimes entire bills from 80 senators.
Senator Cantwell and I, as the managers of the bill on the Senate floor, did everything that we could to make sure that this was a bipartisan bill from committee start to the finish.
The bill has no signature issue. It's a mashup of ideas from left and right, leaving out the more controversial ones. It allows more money for renewable energy research and deployment. It also continues fossil fuel research and streamlines regulation for oil, gas, and mining. A key selling point for Democrats is the permanent reauthorization of the Land and Water Conservation Fund for public land acquisition. A big feature for Republicans is a requirement to speed permit processing for LNG terminals. That was motivated by Lower 48 projects. But Murkowski also added a provision specifically for the Alaska Gas Pipeline, a project still on the drawing board for lack of about $50 billion. Murkowski's bill would move the pipeline's right-of-way as it passes through Denali National Park to avoid a seismic fault.
What we're doing is trying to anticipate ahead of time any hurdle that might be in the way, get it out of the way, which is what we have done with this proposal.
The Alaska Oil and Gas Association praised the bill for fixing the gas line corridor problem and easing the industry's regulatory burden. Robert Cowan of the Union of Concerned Scientists is an advocate for renewable energy.
Just to be completely blunt about it, we really do think there's a missed opportunity here with respect to addressing the climate crisis.
He wrote a blog post headlined, "Senate Energy Bill, Better Than Doing Nothing." But he really does mean that. He says the bill is better for clean energy than no bill, particularly on energy research and modernizing the electric grid.
The bill does a lot of good things with things like microgrids, battery storage, and just essentially a better understanding of how to integrate renewables into the grid.
Cowan says Murkowski had to cope with difficult politics, and he credits her willingness to compromise to avoid partisan impasse.
She's very pragmatic, and I think that she honestly wanted to get something done, and she understood she had to work with the other party to do that. I'm not sure that The House approaches things that way.
The House passed its own very different energy bill, which Murkowski describes as pretty much a Republican bill. Murkowski's next challenge will be to negotiate a version of the two bills that can pass both chambers. For APRN, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The state House and Senate are trying to work out their differences over a bill that would draw money from the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund. The $900 million fund subsidizes the high cost of electricity in rural areas. Because the state government has a $4 billion deficit, some lawmakers have suggested drawing money from the fund to pay for other state costs. Bethel Democratic Senator Lyman Hoffman crafted a bill that would limit the draw from the PCE fund to years when the fund's earnings are more than what's needed for the Power Cost Equalization Program. PCE costs about $40 million per year. The Senate unanimously passed the measure, Senate Bill 196. But the House made changes to the bill. These changes made it less likely that excess fund earnings would be redirected back into the fund. Those changes concern Hoffman. When it was time for the Senate to decide today whether it would agree with the House's changes, Hoffman spoke up.
They changed the formula on how the excess of earnings will be distributed, and I believe that that formula will potentially put the fund in jeopardy, and want to go back and revisit the differences between what the Senate has done, which is a more sound approach to the fund.
As a result, there will be a conference committee to rewrite the bill so that both houses can agree to it. The legislature formed the conference committee on what was an otherwise quiet day in the Capitol. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the problem of disintegrating Anchorage port infrastructure.
This is specific to here. I've worked at the ports and they have corrosion issues, but it's pretty benign compared to this.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Public Media is seeking donations for our 2016 Big Alaska Statewide TV Travel Auction to be held on May 19th and 20th. We're looking for trips, accommodations, activities, and adventures. Your generous donation will help us in our commitment to growth and excellence in programming on Alaska Public Media. There's more information online on our events page on our website at alaskapublic.org.
The port of Anchorage is literally coming apart. threatening to upend the state's essential supply chain in what officials have called a slow-motion disaster. Every year, millions are spent just combating the rapid corrosion of the port's basic infrastructure. But without hundreds of millions for major rehabilitation work approved by lawmakers, the nexus point for much of the state's fuel, food, and building supplies is at risk. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes has part two in our series about the port.
At the very bottom of low tide in Cook Inlet, a small group of representatives from a shipping company, the port, and the mayor's office climb into a little boat. They've come for an up-close look at the latest damage to the steel beams propping up the port. And beneath the docks, there is a forest of thick, brown steel tubes called pilings.
This one, for whatever reason, is corroding as fast as the older ones, even though it's a new structure. It's built along the same lines.
Lon Ellidge is the program manager for CH2M in Alaska, the private company overseeing the port's modernization project. And he's giving an early season tour of just how dire the situation is for the pilings, upon which basically the whole port rests.
Can you put us up on that pile?
Ellidge gets the boat driver to ease us up next to a piling covered in what looks like slimy orange mud. And he tells me to go ahead and touch it.
Right there.
Wow, so what exactly
it's
is this?
It's a combination of the rust and the corrosion that's going on.
Wow, I can almost like push it off. As I'm using my finger to scrape away the rotten steel, Mayor Ethan Berkowitz puts a little bit of it on his tongue. Did you just taste it?
Yeah.
What did it taste like?
Metal, salt.
The sludge, as Berkowitz points out, is organic. But this corrosive process is wearing down the 1,400 or so metal pilings that facilitate an enormous share of the state's economy and commerce. Ellidge says that's because of environmental factors that drag ice and sediment across the pilings like a tidal saw, all the way down to the mud line, where the corrosion is worst.
I don't have the technical term with me, but it is almost like a film that gets on a pile. And then as it washes off, or as the ice takes it off, it exposes fresh pile, and it comes back.
The pilings are invisible to most of us, hidden by tides and obscured by the docks overhead. For all the millions of dollars spent so far on fancy project names like port expansion or modernization, we don't actually get to see what that money buys. And keeping the pilings whole is shockingly expensive.
$3 million a year, and that's for piles that are exposed that they can get to.
Each year, the port spends $3 million applying Band-Aids. They even look like Band-Aids, metal sleeves that get wrapped around the corroded base of each piling. Workers can do almost 100 a season. The sleeves have no structural benefit at all. They simply slow the pace of corrosion. And after 10 to 20 years, Ellidge says, the water eats away the sleeves, too.
Is this a normal problem that a lot of ports that are this age have to deal with?
No. No, this is specific to here. I've worked other ports, and they have corrosion issues, but it's pretty benign compared to this.
In 10 years, when the sleeves start failing, the port expects they'll have to begin taking less weight as ships unload. Currently, taxpayers in Anchorage spend $5 million a year just maintaining what the administration has called marginally adequate operations. And there are already infrastructure problems clogging business operations for the companies that move around 1.5 million tons of cargo into the port every year. Among them is Tote Maritime, which brings in two ships a week to unload everything from groceries to heavy equipment. As our little boat chugs towards Terminal 3, where Tote docks, Vice President Grace Green points towards a dredge that's scraping mud off the seafloor. It's early in the year for dredging to start, but Green says partly because of the recent warm winters, more silt is piling up, making it harder for the company's ships to dock.
There have been several times over the past three winters where we've had to change our operation, either leave early or get creative with ballast on the ship to be able to stay at the dock.
Tote's operations will likely become more efficient if port infrastructure is modernized. But a bigger concern to Green is what'll happen if nothing is done and the much costlier problems that'll create for everyone later on.
The port is basic infrastructure for our state, and if we can't focus on making sure our basic infrastructure is good and sustainable, then that's going to be a problem down the road for all of us.
Green has visited Juneau to lobby lawmakers for finding a strategy to pay for the modernization project. The administration has requested a $290 million bond go before voters on the statewide ballot in November. That would pay for phase two of the project, replacing the terminals used by the shipping companies, Tote and Matson, just down the dock. The new terminals would be built further out into the water at a deeper depth and supported with beefed up pilings designed to survive for decades, which Elledge, engineer in charge of the project, says is essential.
The question was asked, what do we need to do to keep cargo moving across the docks to port for the next 75 years? And the answer is phase one and phase two.
So if the solution is clear, then what's holding up the money? Politics, which we'll hear about in the last part of this series. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
If you're curious about what those pilings look like, a video tour is at our website, alaskapublic.org. For most children who enter foster care, the ultimate goal is to reunite them with their families. But getting to that point takes a lot of work. Parents have to follow case plans set up by the Office of Children's Services and meet requirements like getting substance abuse treatment. Parents also need to maintain relationships with their kids. Alaska Public Media's urban affairs reporter Ann Hillman learned that sometimes that requires a little community support.
Princess Ta'ala entered the foster care system 2.5 years ago. The 14-year-old says she was upset about it, but she understands why it happened.
There were some neglecting issues and physical abuse and emotional and verbal abuse, and I understood that wasn't healthy for anyone to be in like those kind of situations. So when I was little, my dad used to abuse my mom, so it was kind of like a chain reaction.
Princess lounges on the couch of a large playroom filled with a mock stage, toys, books, food, anything that helps families interact. It's a space run by a local Christian nonprofit, Beacon Hill, to give foster kids a place to visit with their parents. Six other kids zip around Princess, asking her questions and some jumping on her lap. She keeps talking about a pretty rough topic, completely unfazed. No one in her first four foster homes would probably guess she could be so forthright.
Other foster homes, I would never utter a word except for yes, no, and thank you. That, like, those simple answers.
Now, she chats with her mom and her siblings and her new extended family, the Stones.
I would say there was an instant connection between the kids. It was really fun.
That's Crystal Stone. She first met Princess when she started volunteering with Beacon Hill. Here's the idea behind the organization. Many families that get involved with OCS don't have healthy support networks. No one intervenes when there's a crisis, and so the situation becomes unsafe for kids. At Beacon Hill, they want to help parents build those networks so when they are reunited with their kids, they're more likely to stay together. The Stones decided to volunteer with Beacon Hill just to befriend Princess and her family. But the relationship grew quickly because they had so much in common.
My music, our faith,
birthdays,
ages of the kids, interests that the kids enjoy, dance, I mean, a lot of it.
After about a year, Princess's two youngest siblings were also taken away from their mom. Instead of them going to an unfamiliar foster family, they went to live with the Stones. Maddie, the Stones' oldest daughter, says the transition wasn't always easy.
You don't get a lot of attention, that's for sure. Sometimes you like it because they're not always on you, but other times when you like want help with things or you want to talk, you have to kind of wait your turn.
But Crystal says they make it work. She says they show all of the kids love and make them feel like a giant family. But they also ensure that Princess's siblings remember their mom. They put up photos of her and the older siblings. They sing songs about visiting days.
You don't want to talk bad about the other parent because that doesn't help that child. It doesn't, you know, build them up or help them feel secure. So you want them to feel as fair as possible, like they're getting a
Love you.
She's interrupted by her son, Prince. He's Princess's little brother. The 5-year-old runs between his two moms and two sets of siblings. The families are going through a transition. Princess and her 10-year-old sister are back with their mom, and Princess says she's thrilled to be home.
It was fun. The first thing I did was grab all my stuff and put it in her room because I was planning to spend the night with her. Like, because I haven't cuddled with her like in a long time.
The younger two, who live with the Stones, may have overnight visits with their mom and sister soon. Crystal says she's happy they'll be reunited. But after more than a year together, it's an emotional change for all of them.
So we just talk about it and we're like, this is hard, this is good, you know, here's the pros, here's the cons, this is how we're gonna get through it.
Both families say this will not be the end of their relationship because now they rely on each other. This is Princess.
They help us in a lot of ways. They give my mom advice and they talk to her when she has no one to talk to. And so, yeah, they're like our second family.
Princess says during her time in foster care, she needed a strong, solid connection with her mother. But through her bond with the Stones and other caring adults, she now realizes that family extends beyond blood. It includes those who support and encourage you when you feel like no one else will. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
How many photos do you figure you shoot out the window when you take a trip? 5, 10, 20? How many of you take a picture every 3 seconds? KUCB's Zoe Sobel caught up with a helicopter crew of modern map makers who shoot 3 to 5,000 photos a day.
Imagine looking out a helicopter window taking pictures as you're traveling 60 miles an hour and you're only 300 feet over the eastern Aleutian Islands. That's a typical day for the 4-person Shore Zone flight crew. But why spend so much time when there are satellites?
People have said, well, why don't you just use satellite imagery so you can get one picture of everything? But of course, the satellite picture also is limited in resolution. And if we're trying to resolve objects on shore that are on the scale of centimeters, that's actually very difficult to do unless you get this kind of imagery.
That's oceanographer Carl Schock. He adds there actually are no maps like this.
There are lots of other coastal maps out there, navigation charts, topographic maps. There are even other maps of shoreline habitats, but none that actually match the imagery up with the map.
The team can map the shoreline biology because the photographs are shot at an angle, which makes it easier to see cliffs and overhanging vegetation. Over a week, they are documenting more than 1,300 miles of shoreline through video and still imagery. But there is a short window every year for photographing the shore. It can only be done during extreme low tides in the spring and summer when the intertidal flora is blooming. To get everything done, the team is on a tight schedule with every 5 minutes mapped out. Any delay can ruin the entire day.
All it takes is one flat tire or, you know, anything were to happen here, and all of a sudden the whole day is shot. We couldn't go out. And that one event would just destroy the whole project, right? We don't have an extra day at the end of the tide to make it up. Coming back for 400 kilometers of shoreline isn't worth it.
Back in the lab in Victoria, British Columbia, the thousands of still images are stitched together using a technique called structure form motion. Every single pixel gets a latitude, longitude, and elevation, creating a three-dimensional model of the shoreline. And that step takes a long time. It will be at least 6 months before this project is completed. Online, everyone can access ShoreZone's maps and video. When the program began in the 1980s, it was intended for oil spill responses. But over the years, that's changed. Schock says people can use the data in many ways.
From beach walkers to people who are planning for making development plans on the coast, or very large ecological questions that have to do with the entire Gulf of Alaska, this project has relevance to all of them.
This trip to the Eastern Aleutians is part of a larger project mapping the entire coast of the Pacific Northwest. Alaska is 90% done, while the coasts of Washington, Oregon, and British Columbia are completed. In Unalaska, I'm Zoe Sobel.
House Bill 126, updating the Alaska Code of Military Justice, has passed the legislature and is on its way to Governor Bill Walker's desk. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
The legislation aims to strengthen the Alaska National Guard's ability to punish soldiers for offenses ranging from minor infractions to larger crimes. Retired Colonel and Deputy Commissioner of the State of Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Bob Dole, says the Guard lacked that authority under the old Alaska Code of Military Justice, which had not been updated since 1955.
We had no means for administrative actions less than seeking a discharge. And that created challenges because there may be some cases where discharge is appropriate, but ideally you catch conduct before it builds up to that point.
The updated code would allow the National Guard to convene court-martials, generally reserved for more severe offenses, and issue nonjudicial punishments for lesser infractions. Dole says it gives the commander a wide set of options.
You now have tools in terms of monetary fines or additional duty or even incarceration for a very rare but egregious example.
The statute also lays out an approved range of punishments for different infractions. That's a layer of definition Dole says has been missing.
It was that lack of definition that frankly rendered the 1955 version unusable. And in 2012, when the National Guard Bureau came in and looked carefully at the Alaska National Guard, this was another area they identified that changes were necessary.
The push to update the code stems from a National Guard Bureau investigation into allegations of sexual assault and misconduct within the Alaska National Guard. While the new Alaska Code of Military Justice adds enforcement mechanisms that the National Guard Bureau report says the Guard lacked, Dole says putting the new code into practice will be the real test.
And frankly, I would say we'll know better after we test drive this thing for a year. But at this point, the DMVA and the National Guard are very happy with how the bill developed.
Next, HB 126 will head to Governor Bill Walker's desk for his signature. If he signs the statute into law, the Guard expects to begin implementing new regulations this summer. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Birchwood, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Ann Hillman, Josh Edge, Zachariah Hughes, and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. At Alaska Pacific University, you will be inspired by the beauty of Alaska, motivated by devoted faculty, and surrounded by independent-minded, creative students pursuing their higher education goals. There's no time like the present to find out what they are all about. It's time to experience APU. Hashtag, this is our classroom. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The weeks are counting down until the first salmon return home to Alaska rivers and streams. Alaska's people live lives that are deeply connected to salmon. Alaska's economy and families are fueled by these relationships. Learn more about Alaska's salmon at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.